I've got to meet someone at Leopold's, and I've got 5 minutes to get there.
Now? You're going now?
I have to.
Leopold's will be shut, she frowned, sitting up in the bed and leaning against a little hill of pillows.
I know, I muttered, pulling on my boots and lacing them. My clothes and boots were soaking wet, but the night was still humid and warm. The storm was easing, and the breeze that had stirred the languid air was dying. I knelt beside the bed and leaned across to kiss the soft skin of her thigh. I've got to go. I gave my word.
Is it that important?
A twitch of irritation creased my forehead with a frown. I was momentarily annoyed that she should press the point when I told her that I'd given my word. That should have been enough. But she was lovely in that moonless light, and she was right to be annoyed, while I wasn't. I'm sorry, I answered softly, running my hand through her thick black hair. How many times had I wanted to do that, to reach out and touch her when we'd stood together?
Go on,
she said quietly, watching me with a witch's concentration.
Go.
I ran to Arthur Bunder Road, through the deserted market. White canvas covers on the market stalls gave them the appearance of shrouded cadavers in the cool room of a morgue. My footsteps running made scattered echoes, as if ghosts were running with me. I crossed Arthur Bunder Road and entered Meerwether Road, running along that boulevard of trees and tall mansions, with no sight or sound of the million people who passed there during each busy day. At the first crossroad, I turned left to avoid the flooded streets, and I saw a cop riding a bicycle ahead. I ran on in the center of the road, and a second bicycle cop pulled out of a dark driveway as I passed. When I was exactly halfway into the side street, the first police jeep appeared at the end of the street. I heard the second jeep behind me, and then the cyclists converged. The jeep pulled up beside me, and I stopped. 5 men got out and surrounded me. There was silence for a few seconds. It was a silence of such delicious menace that the cops were almost drunk with it, and their eyes were lit with riot in the softly falling rain. "What's happening?" I asked in Marathi. "What do you want?"
"Get in the jeep," the commander grunted in English.
"Listen, I speak Marathi, so can't we..." I began, but the commander cut me off with a harsh laugh.
"We know you speak Marathi, motherfucker,"
he answered in Marathi. The other cops laughed.
"We know everything. Now get in the fucking jeep, you sister fucker, or we'll beat you with the lattes and then put you in."
I stepped into the back of the covered jeep, and they sat me on the floor. There were 6 men in the back of the jeep, and they all had their hands on me. We drove the 2 short blocks to the Kalaba police station, across the road from Leopold's. As we entered the police compound, I noticed that the street in front of Leopold's was deserted. Ulla wasn't there, where she'd said she would be. Did she set me up? I wondered, my heart thumping with dread. That made no sense. But still, the thought became a worm that gnawed through all the walls I put up in my mind. The night duty officer was a squat, overweight Maharashtrian, who, like many of his colleagues in the police force, squeezed himself into a uniform that was at least 2 sizes too small for him. The thought occurred to me that the discomfort it must have caused might help to explain his evil disposition. There was certainly no humour in him, or in any of the 10 cops who surrounded me, and I felt a perverse urge to laugh out loud as their scowling, heavy-breathing silence persisted. Then the duty officer addressed his men, and the laughter in me died.
"Take this motherfucker and beat him," he said matter-of-factly.
If he knew that I spoke Marathi and could understand him, he gave no indication of it. He spoke to his men as if I wasn't there.
"Beat him hard. Give him a solid beating. Don't break any bones if you can help it, but beat him hard, and then throw him into the jail with the others."
I ran. I pushed through the circle of cops,
cleared the landing outside the duty room in a single leap, and hit the gravel yard of the compound, running. It was a stupid mistake, and not the last I was to make in the next few months. "Mistakes are like bad loves," Carla once said. "The more you learn from them, the more you wish they'd never happened." My mistake that night took me to the front gate of the compound, where I collided with a roundup party and collapsed in a tangle of tired and helpless men. The cops dragged me back to the duty room, punching and kicking me all the way. They tied my hands behind my back with coarse hemp rope and removed my boots before tying my feet together. The short, fat duty officer produced a thick coil of rope and ordered his men to bind me with it from ankles to shoulders. Puffing and panting with his rage, he watched as I was trussed in so many coils of rope that I resembled an Egyptian mummy. The cops then dragged me to an adjoining room and hoisted me up to hang me at chest height from a hook, face down, with the hook jammed through several coils of rope at my back.
"Aeroplane," the duty officer growled through clenched teeth.
The cops spun me around, faster and faster. The hook held my bound hands in the bunched ropes, and my head hung down, level with my drooping feet. I whirled and spun until I lost my sense of up or down in the twirling room. Then the beatings began. 5 or 6 men hit my spinning body as hard and as often as they could, cracking their cane lattes against my skin. The stinging blows struck with piercing pain through the ropes, and on my face, arms, legs, and feet. I could sense that I was bleeding. The screaming rose up in me, but I clenched my jaws and gave the pain no sound of my own. I wouldn't let them have it. I wouldn't let them hear me scream. Silence is the tortured man's revenge. Hands reached out, stopping my body, holding it still, while the room continued to whirl. Then they spun me in the opposite direction, and the beating began again. When their sport was done, they dragged me up the metal steps to the lockup, the same metal steps I'd climbed with Prabhakar when I'd tried to help Kano's bear handlers. "Will someone come to help me?" I asked myself. No one had seen my arrest on the deserted street, and no one knew where I was. Ulla, if she came to Leopold's at all, if she wasn't actually involved in my arrest, wouldn't know that I'd been arrested. And Carla. What could Carla think but that I'd abandoned her after we'd made love? She wouldn't find me. Prison systems are black holes for human bodies. No light escapes from them, and no news. With that mysterious arrest, I'd vanished into one of the city's darkest black holes. I'd disappeared from the city as completely as if I'd caught a plane to Africa. And why was I arrested? The questions buzzed and swarmed in my whirling mind. Did they know who I really was? If they didn't know, if it was something else, if it had nothing to do with who I really was, there would still be questions, identification procedures, maybe even fingerprint checks. My prints were on file all over the world, through the Interpol agency. It was only a question of time before my real identity emerged. I had to get a message out to someone. Who could help me? Who was powerful enough to help me? Kader Bhai, Lord Abdel Kader Khan. With all of his contacts in the city, especially in the Kolaba area, he would surely find out that I'd been arrested. In time, Kader Bhai would know. Until then, I had to sit tight and try to get a message out to him. Trussed up in the mummifying ropes, dragged up the hard metal stairs one bruising bump at a time, I forced my thoughts to settle on that mantra, and I repeated it to the thumping beat of my heart. Get a message to Kader Bhai. Get a message to Kader Bhai. At the top landing of the stairs, they threw me into the long prison corridor. The duty officer ordered prisoners to remove the ropes from my body. He stood in the gateway to the lockup, watching them with his fists on his hips. At one point, he kicked me 2-3 times to encourage them to work faster. When the last of the ropes was removed and passed through to the guards. He ordered them to lift me and stand me up, facing him at the open gate. I felt their hands numbly on my deadened skin, and I opened my eyes through blood to see his grimace of a smile. He spoke to me in Marathi and then spat in my face. I tried to raise my arm to hit back at him, but the other prisoners held me fast. Their hands were gentle but firm. They helped me into the archway of the first open cell room and eased me to the concrete floor. I looked up to see his face as he shut the gate. Loosely but accurately translated, he'd said to me, "You're fucked. Your life is over." I saw the steel bars of the gate swing shut and felt the creeping coldness numb my heart. Metal slammed against metal. The keys jangled and turned in the lock. I looked into the eyes of the men around me. The dead eyes and the frenzied, the resentful eyes and the fearing. Somewhere deep inside me, a drum began to beat. It might have been my heart. I felt my body, my whole body, tense and clench as if it was a fist. There was a taste, thick and bitter, at the back of my mouth. I struggled to swallow it down, and then I knew. I remembered. It was the taste of hatred. My hatred, theirs, the guards, and the world's. Prisons are the temples where devils learn to pray. Every time we turn the key, we twist the knife of fate. Because every time we cage a man, we close him in with hate. Chapter 20. The first floor of the lockup at Colaba Police Station had four big cell rooms beyond the flexi-steel gate. A corridor connected the four rooms. On one side, the corridor gave access to the rooms. On the other side, it looked out, through steel mesh, onto the quadrangle of the police compound. There were more cells below. It was in one of those ground floor cells that Kano the Bear had been detained. Transients, who spent only one or two nights in custody, were held on the ground floor. Anyone likely to stay for a week or longer in the Colaba lockup climbed the steps or was dragged up them, as I was, and passed through the sliding steel gate into one of hell's antechambers. There were no doors beyond the steel gate. Each of the four rooms was accessed through a blank arch that was slightly wider than the average house doorway. The rooms were roughly 3 meters square. The corridor was just wide enough for two men to pass each other with their shoulders touching, and it was about 16 meters long. At the end of the corridor, there was a urinal and a keyhole-shaped squatting toilet, both without doors. A tap, providing water for washing and drinking, was fixed above the urinal. The four rooms and corridor might have held 40 men with an acceptable level of discomfort. When I woke up on my first morning, I discovered that there were, in fact, 240 of us. The place was a hive, a termite's nest, a writhing mass of human beings pressing against one another with every little movement of an arm or a leg. The toilet was ankle-deep in shit. The urinal overflowed. A stinking swamp oozed out of them into the far end of the corridor. The still, thickly humid monsoon air was clogged with moanings, murmurings, talking, complaining, shouting, and the screams, every few hours, of men going mad. I remained there for 3 weeks. The first of the four rooms, where I'd slept the first night, held only 15 men. It was furthest from the sickening smell of the toilet. It was clean. There was space to lie down. The men who lived in that room were all rich. Rich enough to pay the cops to beat up anyone who tried to squeeze in without an invitation. The room was known as the Taj Mahal, and its residents were known as the Pandra Kumar, the 15 princes. The second room held 25 men. I learned that they were all crooks, men who'd served hard time at least once before, and were prepared to fight, fast and dirty, to preserve a space for themselves. Their room was known as the Chor Mahal, the abode of thieves. and the men were known as the Black Hats, the Kala Topis, like Ranjit's lepers, because convicted thieves at the infamous Arthur Road prison were forced to wear a black hat with their prison uniform. The third room had 40 men wedged into it, sitting shoulder to shoulder around the walls and taking turns to stretch out in the little space left in the centre of the room. They weren't as hard as the men in the second room, but they were proud and willing. They claimed the small squares of space they sat in, and then struggled to hold them against incursions by newcomers. They were constantly under pressure. Every day, at least one of them lost a fight and lost his place to a new, tougher man. Still, the optimal number for the third room was 40 men, and since it rarely rose above that limit, it was known as the Chalis Mahal, or the abode of the 40. The fourth room was known in the lock-up slang as the Dukh Mahal, or the abode of suffering. But many men preferred to use the name that the Kolaba police had given the last cell in the row. The detection room. When a new man entered the corridor for the first time, through the steel gate, he sometimes tried his luck in the first room. Every one of the 15 men in that room, and not a few lackeys in the corridor, would rise up, shoving and threatening him away, shouting, next room, bastard. Driven along the corridor by the writhing, toiling press of bodies, the man might try to enter the second room. If no one there knew him, whoever happened to be near the door would give him a clip, a smack in the mouth. Next room, motherfucker. If the man, badly rattled by then, tried to enter the third room as he was pushed further along the corridor, the two or three men who sat or stood in the doorway of that room would punch and kick at him. Next room, sister fucker. When the new man found himself shoved all the way to the fourth room, the detection room, he would be greeted as an old and very welcome friend. Come in, friend. Come in, brother. Those foolish enough to enter were beaten and stripped naked by the 50 or 60 men who crushed into that black and fetid room. Their clothes were distributed according to a waiting list, determined by a precise and perpetually adjusted pecking order. Their body cavities were thoroughly searched for jewellery, drugs, or money. Any valuables went to the king of the detection room. During my weeks there, the king of the last room was a huge gorilla of a man with no neck and a hairline that began little more than the thickness of a thumb above his single thick eyebrow. The new men received filthy rags to wear, the rags that had been discarded by those who'd received their stolen clothes. They then had two options: to leave the room and fend for themselves with the 100 men who lived in the impossibly crowded corridor, or to join the detection room gang and wait for opportunities to prey on other hapless new men in the chain of muggings. From what I saw in those 3 weeks, about one man in every five who was brutalized and dispossessed in that last room took the second option. Even the corridor had its pecking order, its struggles over a foothold of space, and its claim jumpers who challenged the strength or bravery of rivals. Places near the front gate and relatively far from the toilet were prized. Yet even at the foul end of the corridor, where shit and piss flowed onto the floor in a repulsive, reeking sludge, men fought each other for an inch of space that was slightly shallower in the muck. A few of those men who were forced to the end of the corridor, forced to stand ankle-deep in shit all day and all night, finally fell down and died. One man died in the lock-up while I was there, and several others were carried out in a state so close to death that I'd found it impossible to rouse them to consciousness. Others summoned the raging madness required to fight their way, minute by minute, hour by hour, meter by meter, day by day and man by man, along the concrete anaconda's intestine, to a place where they could stand and go on living, until the beast disgorged them through the same steel jaws that had swallowed their lives whole. We received one meal a day, at 4 in the afternoon. It was dal and roti, mostly, or rice with a thin curry sauce. There was also chai and a slice of bread in the early morning. The prisoners tried to organize themselves into two orderly lines, approaching and leaving the gate where the cops gave out food. But the crush of bodies and the desperate hunger and the greed of a few caused chaos at every meal. Many men missed out. Some went hungry for a day or longer. We all received a flat aluminium plate when we entered the lockup. The plate was our only legal possession. There was no cutlery. We ate with our hands. And there were no cups. Chai was ladled out onto the plates, and we sucked it off them with our mouths pressed into the thin pool of liquid. But the plates had other uses, first among which was in the manufacture of a makeshift stove. If two aluminium plates were bent into V-shapes and used as stands, a third plate could rest on top of them. With a fuel source burning in the space between the bent, inverted plates and beneath the flat plate, a stove was created, which could be used to reheat tea or food. The ideal fuel source was a flat rubber sandal. When one of those rubber shoes was lit at one end, it burned evenly and slowly all the way to the other end. The smoke given off was acrid and thick, with a greasy soot that settled on everything it touched. The detection room, where two such stoves burned for some time every night, was blackened across its filthy floor and walls, as were the faces of all the men who lived there. The stoves were a source of income for the kingpins in the detection room. They used them to reheat chai and saved food, at a price, for the rich men in room one. The guards allowed deliveries of food and drink, for those who could afford it, during the day. But nothing passed through the gate at night. The 15 princes, unstinting in the pursuit of their comforts, had bribed the cops to provide a small saucepan and several plastic bottles and containers in which to store chai and food. In that way, when deliveries had ceased every night, the princes still enjoyed hot chai and snacks. Because the aluminium plates could only be used as stoves for so long before they became brittle and collapsed, new plates were always in demand. Because food and chai, and even the rubber sandals used as fuel, could all be turned into money, they too were always required. The weakest men lost their sandals, their plates, and their food. Those with the heart to help them, by sharing the use of their plates, had to eat in scrambled gulps and then hand on the plates to be used again. As many as four men often ate off one plate, in that way, during the 6 or 7 minutes that the cops allowed for food to be distributed at the steel gate. Every day, I looked into the eyes of starving men. I saw them watching other men shove hot food too quickly into their mouths with their fingers, while cops ladled out the last of the meals. I saw them every day, watching and waiting and fearing that they might miss out. The truth that filled their eyes was something we only ever know about ourselves in cruel and desperate hunger. I took it into myself, that truth, and the part of my heart that broke to see it has never healed. And every night in room one, the Taj Mahal, the 15 princes ate a hot meal and drank hot sweet tea, heated up on the makeshift stoves in the detection room, before stretching out to sleep. Even the princes, of course, had to use the toilet. The procedure was as vile and dehumanizing for them as it was for the poorest prisoner. And in that, if nothing else, we were all nearly equal. The long journey through the jungle of limbs and bodies in the corridor ended in the stinking swamp. There, the rich men, like the rest of us, packed their nostrils with strips of cloth torn from a shirt or singlet and clamped a lit beady cigarette between their teeth to fight the smell. With pants hitched to their knees and sandals held in their hand, they then waded barefoot into the sewage to squat over the keyhole toilet. The toilet was unblocked and functioned well enough. But with more than 200 men using it once or twice a day, every day, it was soon fouled by those who missed the keyhole in the floor. Eventually, the piles of excrement slid down into the pools of urine that flowed from the shallow urinal. That was the filthy sludge through which we waded on our way to the toilet. Wading back to the urinal, the rich men then washed their hands and feet at the tap, without soap, and stepped on bundles of rags that were heaped like stepping stones, and formed a makeshift dam before the entrance to the detection room. For the price of a cigarette butt or a half-smoked beedie, men squatting in the muck would clean their feet once more with rags, and then they could begin the long struggle back along the corridor. It was presumed that I had money, because I was a white foreigner, so the rich men in room one had invited me to join them when I'd woken in their room on my first morning. The idea appalled me. I'd been raised in a family of Fabian socialists, and I'd inherited their stubborn, impractical revulsion for social inequity in all its forms. Imbued with their principles, and being a product, as a young man, of a revolutionary age, I'd become a revolutionary myself. Some of that commitment to the cause, as my mother had called it, was still there, in the core of my being. Moreover, I'd been living in a slum for many months with the city's poor. So I refused the offer, reluctantly, I must admit, to enjoy the comforts of the rich. Instead, I muscled my way into the second room with the hard men who'd all served time in prison. There was a brief scuffle at the doorway, but when it was clear that I was prepared to fight for a place in the abode of thieves, they shuffled themselves around and made room for me. Still, there was some resentment. The black hats, like self-respecting crooks everywhere, were proud men. It wasn't long before they manufactured an opportunity to test me out. On one of the long, squirming trips back from the toilet, 3 days after my arrest, a man in the crowd of prisoners tried to wrestle my plate away from me. I shouted a warning in Hindi and Marathi, making the threat as anatomically impolite as my vocabulary would allow. It didn't stop him. The man was taller than I was, and bigger by some 30 kilos. His hands grasped the plate near my own, and we both pulled. But neither of us had the gross strength to wrest it away. All the men fell silent. Their breathing was a tidal swirl of sound and warm air around us. It was a face-off. Make or break. I made my way in that world, right there and then, or I broke down and let myself be forced into the fetid swamp at the end of the corridor. Using the man's grip on the plate as leverage, I smashed my head onto the bridge of his nose 5, 6, 7 times, and then again on the point of his chin as he tried to pull away. Alarm surged through the crowd. A dozen pairs of hands shoved at us, crushing our bodies and faces together. Packed into the press of frightened men, unable to move my hands and unwilling to release the plate, I bit into his face. My teeth pierced his cheek until I tasted his blood in my mouth. He dropped the plate and screamed. Thrashing wildly, he scrambled through the bodies in the corridor to the steel gate. I followed him, with my hand reaching out for his back. Grasping the bars, he shook the gate and screeched for help. I caught him just as the watchman turned his keys in the lock. I grabbed at him as he escaped through the gate. His T-shirt stretched behind him, and for a second he was stuck there, his legs running but his body quite still. Then the T-shirt gave way, and I was left with a chunk of it in my hand as the man staggered through the opening. He cowered behind the watchman, his back pressed against the wall. His face was opened at the cheek where my teeth had cut him, and blood streamed from his nose down his throat to his chest. The gate slammed shut. The cop stared, smiling inscrutably, as I used the T-shirt to wipe the blood from my hands and the plate. Satisfied, I threw the shirt at the gate. I turned and squeezed my way through the silent crowd, taking my place in the thieves' room once more.
"Nice move, brother,"
the young man sitting beside me said in English. "Not really," I replied. I was trying for his ear.
"Ooh,"
he winced, pursing his lips.
"But probably more of a nourishment in his ear, isn't it, than the fucking food they're giving us here, man. What is your case?"
"I don't know."
"You don't know?"
"They picked me up at night and brought me here. They haven't told me what I'm charged with, or why I'm here." I didn't ask him what he was in for, because the Australian prison protocol, followed by crooks of the old school, crooks who know there is a protocol, and who taught me about it when I'd started my jail sentence with them, dictates that you don't ask a man about the crimes he might have committed until you like him enough to make him a friend, or dislike him enough to make him an enemy.
They gave you a solid pasting, man.
The aeroplane, they called it.
Ooh,
he winced again, hunching his shoulders.
I hate that fucking aeroplane, brother. They tied me up in the ropes so tight once that it took 3 days for my arm to get the feeling back. And you know how your body swells the fuck up inside the ropes when they've been beating you for a while now? My name is Mahesh. What is your good name?
They call me Lin.
Lin?
Yeah.
Interesting name, man. Where did you learn to speak Marathi? Like when you were calling that fellow a motherfucker before you started eating on his face?
In a village.
Must be some sort of tough village, that one.
I smiled for the first time since the police had picked me up. In prison, a man rations his smiles, because predatory men see smiling as a weakness, weak men see it as an invitation, and prison guards see it as a provocation to some new torment. I learned the swearing here, in Bombay, I explained. How long do people usually stay here? Mahesh sighed, and his broad, dark face folded inward in a resigned frown. His wide-spaced brown eyes were so deep-set that they seemed to be hiding or seeking shelter beneath the ridge of his scarred brow. His wide nose, broken more than once, dominated his face and gave him a tougher look than his small mouth and rounded chin might have managed on their own.
That is nobody knows, brother,
he replied, the light dimming in his eyes. It was the sort of response Prabhakar might have made, and I suddenly missed my little friend in a second of loneliness that speared my heart.
I came here 2 days before you. There's a rumor we will be taking a truck to the road in 2 or 3 weeks.
The road?
Arthur Road Jail, man.
I have to get a message out to someone.
You'll have to wait for that, Lin. The guards here, the cops, they've been telling all of us here not to help you. It's like somebody put a curse on you, my brother. I'm probably going to get some shit on my head just for talking to you only, but what the fuck, yeah?
I've got to get a message out, I repeated, my lips bared from my teeth.
Well, none of the guys leaving here will help you, Lin. They're afraid, like mice in a bag full of cobras. But you'll be able to get some messages out from Arthur Road. It's a fucking big jail, no problem. 12,000 men inside. Government says less than so many, but everybody of us, we know there's 12,000 of men inside. But it's still a lot better than this. If you go to the road, you'll be with me in maybe 3 weeks. My case is stealing. Stealing from the constructions. Copper wire, plastic pipes. 3 times in jail already for the same things. This time number 4. What to say, brother? I'm what they call a serial offensive against the pilfering law. This time it is 3 years for me, if lucky, and 5 years if not lucky. If you go to Arthur Road, you go with me. Then we'll try to get your messages out of the jail. Tick high. Until then, we smoke and pray to the God and bite any sister fuckers who try to take our plates, nah.
And for 3 weeks, we did just that. We smoked too much, and we troubled deaf heaven with our prayers, and we fought with some men, and sometimes we comforted other men who were losing the will to smoke and pray and fight. And one day they came to take our fingerprints, pressing the black traitorous loops and whorls onto a page that promised to tell a truth, a vile truth and nothing but that truth. And then Mahesh and I were crushed with other men into an ancient blue prison truck. 80 men in the black womb of the truck, where 30 would have been too many, and driven toward Arthur Road Prison at reckless speeds through the streets of the city that we all loved too much. Inside the gates of the prison, guards dragged us off the tailgate of the truck and told us to squat on the ground, while other guards processed us and signed us into the prison, one by one. It took 4 hours, shuffling forward and squatting on our haunches, and they left me till last. The guards had been told that I understood Marathi. Their watch commander tested the assertion, when I was alone with them, by ordering me to stand. I stood up on painfully stiff legs, and he ordered me to squat again. When I squatted down, he ordered me to stand again. That might have gone on indefinitely, judging by the hilarity it provoked in the gallery of surrounding guards. But I refused to play. He continued to give the commands, but I ignored him. When he stopped, we stared at one another, across the kind of silence I've only ever known in prisons or on the battlefield. It's a silence you can feel on your skin. It's a silence you can smell and taste and even hear somehow, in the dark space at the back of your head. Slowly, the commander's sinful smile retreated into the snarl of hate that had spawned it. He spat on the ground at my feet.
"British built this jail in the time of Raj," he hissed at me, showing teeth. "They did chain Indian men here, whip them here, hang them here until dead. Now we run the jail, and you are a British prisoner."
"Excuse me, sir," I said, with the most formal politeness that the Marathi language offers, "but I am not British. I am from New Zealand."
"You are British,"
he screamed, spraying my face with his saliva. "I'm afraid not."
"Yes, you are British. All British,"
he replied, the snarl moving outward to a malignant smile once more.
"You are British, and we run the jail. You go through that way."
He pointed towards an archway that led into the prison's interior. There was a hard right turn, just a little way into the arch. And I knew, the way all animals know, that harm waited for me there. To encourage me, the guards rammed their batons into my back. I stumbled into the arch and took the right turn. Some 20 men were waiting for me, lined up on either side of the long corridor, and armed with bamboo sticks. I knew the gauntlet well, better than any man should. There'd been another tunnel of pain in another country, the punishment unit in the prison I'd escaped from in Australia. Those guards had made us run their gauntlet down a long, narrow corridor leading to the tiny exercise yards. And as we ran, they'd swung their batons and kicked us all the way to the steel door at the end of the line. I stood in the harsh electric light of that new tunnel in Bombay's Arthur Road prison, and I wanted to laugh. "Hey, guys," I wanted to say, "can't you be a little more original?" But I couldn't speak. Fear dries a man's mouth, and hate strangles him. That's why hate has no great literature. Real fear and real hate have no words. I walked slowly forward. The men were dressed in white shirts and shorts, with white caps on their heads, and wide black leather belts around their waists. The brass buckles on those belts carried numbers and a title. The title was Convict Overseer. They weren't prison guards, I soon discovered. In the Indian prison system, inherited from the days of the British Raj, the prison guards had very little to do with the day-to-day operation of the prison. Those everyday tasks of maintaining routines, order and discipline were the preserve of convict overseers. Convicted murderers and other long-term serial offenders received sentences of 15 years or more. During the first 5 of those years, they were common prisoners. During the second 5 years, they earned the privilege of a job in the kitchen, laundry, prison industries, or clean-up gangs. During the third and final 5 years, they often accepted the hat, leather belt, and bamboo stick of a convict overseer. Then, The power of life and death was in their hands. Two lines of those convicted killers, who'd become guards themselves, awaited me in the tunnel. They raised their sticks and fixed their eyes on me, anticipating a charging run that might deprive them of the sporting chance to inflict some pain. I didn't run. I wish I could say now that I walked that night and didn't run because of something noble and brave that I found inside myself. But I can't. I've thought about it often. I've recalled and relived that walk 1,000 times. And each time I remember it, there's less certainty about the why of it. Every virtuous act has some dark secret in its heart, Kadarbai once told me. And every risk we take contains a mystery that can't be solved. I walked toward them, slowly. And I began to think of the long concrete path that leads from the shore to the shrine at Haji Ali, the mosque that floats like a great moored ship on the moonlit sea. That view of the monument to the revered saint, and the journey between the waves to the floating pavilions, was one of my beloved images of the city. Its beauty for me was like the angel that a man sees in the sleeping face of the woman he loves. And it might have been just that, beauty alone, that saved me. I was walking into the worst of the city, one of her cruelest and most iniquitous defiles. But some instinct flooded my mind with a loveliness I'd found in her. That path across the sea to the white minarets of the saint's tomb. The bamboo sticks whipped and cracked, ripping and slashing at my arms and legs and back. Some blows hit my head, my neck and my face. Swung with maximum force by strong arms against bare skin, the blows from the bamboo sticks were a cross between a hot metal burn and an electric shock. The sticks were split at the ends. They opened razor-thin cuts wherever they landed. Blood began to run from my face and the exposed skin on my arms. I walked on as slowly and steadily as I could. I flinched often when the sticks smacked into my face or across my ear, but I never cringed or cowered or raised my hands. To keep my hands at my sides, I clutched at the legs of my jeans. And the attack, which had begun with frenzied violence, dwindled to fewer blows as I walked the gauntlet. It ceased altogether when I reached the last men in the lines. It was a kind of victory, seeing those men lower their sticks and their eyes as I passed them. The only victory that really counts in prison, an old-timer in the Australian jail once said to me, is survival. But survival means more than simply being alive. It's not just the body that must survive a jail term. The spirit and the will and the heart have to make it through as well. If any one of them is broken or destroyed, the man whose living body walks through the gate at the end of his sentence can't be said to have survived it. And it's for those small victories of the heart and the spirit and the will that we sometimes risk the body that cradles them. The overseers and several guards brought me through the prison, in the darkening evening, to one of the many dormitory blocks. The large high-ceilinged room was 25 paces long and 10 paces wide. There were barred windows that gave views of open areas around the building, and there were 2 tall steel gates, one at either end of the room. In a bathroom near one entrance, there were 3 clean keyhole toilets. When the guards locked us in for the night, there were 180 prisoners in that room and 20 convict overseers. 1/4 of the room was reserved for the overseers. They had their own stack of clean blankets. They arranged them with free space all around and in piles 8 or 10 thick to provide soft beds. The rest of us were squeezed into 2 lines in the remaining 3/4 of the room, with a no-man's land of about 4 paces between our part of the room and the area claimed by the overseers. Each of us had 1 blanket, taken from a neatly folded stack at the crowded end of the room. The blankets were folded down their length and placed side to side on the stone floor against the long walls. We lay down on the narrow blankets with our shoulders rubbing against one another. Our heads touched the side walls, and our feet pointed in toward the center of the room. The bright lights remained on all night. The overseers on night watch took turns to walk the length of the room between the rows of feet. They all carried whistles on chains around their necks, which they used to summon the guards in the event of any trouble they couldn't handle themselves. I soon learned that they were reluctant to use the whistle, and there was very little trouble that was beyond their power. The overseers gave me 5 minutes to wash the drying blood off my face and neck and arms, and to use the immaculately clean squat toilet. When I returned to the main room, they offered me the opportunity to sleep at their end of the room. They assumed, no doubt, that my white skin was connected to a supply of money. And they may have allowed themselves, in some small way, to be influenced by the fact that I'd walked their gauntlet without running. Whatever their reasons, I couldn't do it. They were the very men who'd beaten me only minutes before, the men who'd transformed themselves into prison guards, and I refused their offer. It was a huge mistake. As I walked to the far end of the room, took a blanket from the pile, and put it down next to Mahesh, they sneered and laughed. They were furious that I'd rejected the rare offer to join them. And they conspired, as cowards with power often will, to break my spirit. In the night, I woke from monstrous dreams with a piercing pain in my back. I sat up, scratching at my back, to find an insect about the size of a small thumbtack attached to my skin. I wrenched it loose and put it on the stone floor to examine it. The creature was dark grey, fat, swollen almost to round, with a multitude of legs. I squashed it with my hand. Blood spurted out. It was my own blood. The creature had feasted itself on me in my sleep. At once, a foul smell filled my nostrils. It was my first encounter with the parasite known as Kadmal, the scourge of prisoners in the Arthur Road prison. Nothing stopped them. They bit and sucked blood every night. The small round wounds they made soon festered into poison-filled pustules. In any one night there were 3 to 5 bites, in a week there were 20, and in a month there were 100 suppurating infected sores on a man's body. And nothing stopped them. I stared at the stupid mess that the squashed Kadmal made, stunned to see how much blood the tiny creature had managed to drain from me. Suddenly there was a stabbing pain at my ear as the night watch overseer swung his bamboo lathi against my head. I started up in anger, but Mahesh stopped me. His hands locked onto my arm, and he dragged me down with all his weight. The overseer glared at me until I lay down again. He resumed his pacing of the brightly lit room, and Mahesh mouthed a warning to me. Our faces were only a hand's width apart. All along the two lines of sleepers, men were jammed together, arms and legs intertwined in sleep. The terror that spiked in Mahesh's eyes, and the whimper that he clamped with a hand to his mouth, were the last things that I saw and heard on that first night.
"No matter what they do," he whispered, "for the sake of your life, don't do anything to them in return. This is not a living place, Lin. We are all dead men here. You can't do anything."
I closed my eyes and closed my heart and willed myself to sleep. Chapter 21. The overseers woke us a little after dawn, beating any man unfortunate enough to be asleep when they reached him. I was awake and ready, yet I too received a blow from a stick. I growled in anger and started up quickly, but Mahesh stopped me once again. We folded our blankets according to a precise pattern and placed them in the pile at our end of the room. The guards opened the large steel gates from the outside, and we filed out of the room to assemble for the morning wash. The rectangular bathing area, something like an empty above-ground pool or a dry stone pond, had a huge cast-iron tank at one end. As we approached, a prisoner opened a valve at the base of the tank, allowing a small jet of water to escape from a pipe that protruded at about shin height. He scampered up a steel ladder and sat on top of the tank to watch. Men rushed for the pipe and held their flat aluminium plates under the thin stream of water that issued from it. The crush of men at the tank was 10 deep and 10 wide, a huge knot of muscle and bone, straining and struggling to reach the pipe. I waited until the crowd thinned out, watching the men wash themselves with the little water available. A few men, 1 in 20, had pieces of soap and attempted to lather themselves before returning to the pipe for more water. By the time I approached the pipe, the tank was almost empty. The trickle of water that I collected in my plate was wriggling with hundreds of maggot-like creatures. I thrust the plate away in disgust, and several men around me laughed.
"Water worms, brother," Mahesh said,
filling his plate with the squirming, thrashing, semi-transparent creatures. He tipped the plate of wriggling things over his chest and back and reached out to fill another plate.
"They live in the tanks. When the water gets low, the water worms come out of the tap, so many, brother. But no problem. They can't hurt you. They don't bite like the Kadmal. They just drop down and die in the cold air, you see. The other fellows fight to get water with not many worms inside. But if we wait, we get plenty of worms, but plenty of water also. This is better, yes? Come on, chalo. You better grab some if you want a wash before tomorrow morning. This is it, brother. We can't be washing in the dormitory. That is a special for the overseers only. They let you wash there last night because you had a lot of blood on you. But you'll never use that washing place again. We use the toilet inside, but we don't wash there. This is your only washing, brother."
I held the plate under the ever-diminishing trickle of water and then tipped the seething mass of worms over my chest and back, as Mahesh had done. Like all the Indian men I knew, I wore a pair of shorts, the over-underpants, Prabhakar had called them in the village, under my jeans. I discarded the jeans, and the next plate full of wriggling beasts went down the front of my shorts. By the time the overseers began hitting us with their sticks to herd us back into the dormitory, I was as clean as it was possible to be without soap and using worm-infested water. In the dormitory, we squatted for an hour while we waited for the guards to make the morning head count. After a time, the squatting caused us excruciating pain in our legs. Whenever anyone tried to stretch or straighten his legs, however, one of the patrolling overseers struck him a vicious blow. I didn't move in the line. I didn't want them to have the satisfaction of seeing me give in to the pain. But as I closed my eyes in sweating concentration, one of them struck me anyway, without cause or provocation. I began to stand, and once again, I felt the restraining hands of Mahesh warning me to be still. When a second, third, and then a fourth blow ripped into my ear, over the space of 15 minutes, I snapped.
"Come here, you fucking coward!"
I shouted, standing and pointing at the last man who'd struck me. The overseer, a huge and obese man, known to friend and foe alike as Big Rahul, towered over most of the other men in the room.
"I'll take that fucking stick and jam it so far up your ass I'll be able to see it in your eyes!"
Silence imploded in the room, swallowing every sound. No one moved. Big Rahul stared. His broad expression, a parody of amused condescension, was infuriating. Slowly the convict overseers began to converge in support of him.
"Come here!"
I shouted in Hindi.
"Come on, hero! Let's go! I'm ready!"
Suddenly Mahesh and 5 or 6 other prisoners rose up all around me and clung to my body, trying to force me down to a squatting position.
"Please, Lin," Mahesh hissed. "Please, brother, please. Sit down again, please. And know what I'm telling you. Please, please."
There was a moment while they pulled at my arms and shoulders, When Big Rahul and I made the kind of eye contact where each man knows everything about the violence in the other, his supercilious grin faded, and his eyes fluttered their signal of defeat. He knew it, and I knew it. He was afraid of me. I allowed the men to drag me down to a squatting position. He turned on his heel and struck out reflexively at the nearest man crouching in the ranks. The tension in the room dissolved, and the headcount resumed. Breakfast consisted of a single large chapati. We chewed them and sipped water during the 5 minutes allowed, and then the overseers marched us out of the room. We crossed several immaculately clean courtyards. In a broad avenue between fenced areas, the overseers forced us to squat in the morning sunlight while we waited to have our heads shaved. The barber's wooden stools were in the shade of a tall tree. Every new prisoner had his hair clipped by one barber, and then a second barber shaved his head with a straight razor. As we were waiting, we heard shouts coming from one of the fenced compounds near the barber's courtyard. Mahesh nudged me, nodding his head for me to watch. 10 convict overseers dragged a man into the deserted compound beyond the wire fence. There were ropes attached to the man's wrists and waist. More ropes were attached to the buckles and rings of a thick leather collar fitted tightly around the man's neck. Teams of overseers were playing tug-of-war on the wrist ropes. The man was very tall and strong. His neck was as thick as the barrel of a cannon, and his powerful chest and back rippled with muscles. He was African. I recognized him. It was Hassan Obikwa's driver, Rahim, the man I'd helped escape from the mob near Regal Circle. We watched in a tight, fast-breathing silence. They maneuvered Rahim to the center of the compound, near a stone block about a meter high and a meter wide. He struggled and resisted them, but it was useless. More overseers joined in with more ropes. Rahim's legs went out from under him. 3 men pulled on each wrist rope with all their strength. His arms were drawn out so hard from his sides that I thought they might be torn from the sockets. His legs were splayed out at an excruciatingly unnatural angle. Other men, pulling on the ropes that passed through the leather collar, dragged his body toward the stone block. Using the ropes, the overseers stretched his left arm out, with the hand and forearm resting on the block. Rahim lay beside the block, his other arm stretched out by another team of overseers. One of the overseers then climbed onto the block and jumped off onto Rahim's arm with both feet, snapping the arm backwards in a sickening crunch of gristle and bone. He couldn't scream because the collar at his throat was too tight, but his mouth opened and closed on the scream that we made for him in our minds. His legs began to twitch and spasm. A violent shiver passed through his whole body, ending in a rapid shaking of his head that would have been funny if it wasn't so frightening. The overseers dragged him around until his right arm was resting on the block. The same man climbed the stone, talking all the while to one of his friends, pulling tension on a rope. After a pause, he blew his nose with his fingers, scratched himself, and jumped onto the right arm, snapping it backwards. Rahim lost consciousness. The convict overseers looped their ropes around his ankles and then dragged his body out of the compound. His arms flopped and flapped behind his body, as limp and lifeless as long black socks filled with sand.
"You see?"
Mahesh whispered. "What was that all about?"
"He hit one of the overseers,"
Mahesh answered in a terrified whisper.
"That's why I stopped you. That's what they can do."
Another man leaned close to us, speaking quickly.
"And here, there is no guarantee of doctor," he breathed. "Maybe you see doctor, maybe no. Maybe that black fellow will live, maybe not live. No good luck to hit overseer, Baba."
Big Rahul walked towards us, resting the bamboo stick on his shoulder. He paused beside me and brought the stick down with a lazy smack across my back. His laughter, as he walked away down the line of waiting men, was brutally loud. But it was also weak and false, and it didn't fool me. I'd heard that laugh before, in another prison.